we're surrounded by messages that are carefully designed to try to influence what we believe and what we do. And almost all of those messages have nothing to do with your individual best interest. That is, they almost all of them have to do with interests of other groups or parties. Once you start to see that, then you realize that critical thinking is minimally a kind of logical self-defense that can help to protect you from the manipulations that are constantly going on around you.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, checking your privilege, the five pillars of critical thinking, and stereotyping, when it works and when it doesn't. All coming up on this episode of the Humanist Hour. Hello, my name is Beau Bennett. Welcome to the Humanist Hour. I will be your host for this week's episode. I was reading my Facebook timeline, as I usually do before bedtime, and an article caught my attention, posted by one of my extremely conservative relatives. The title was, "I Checked My Privilege and It's Doing Just Fine," posted on the, quote, news, unquote, site, townhall.com. This, of course, is about this whole idea of privilege, generally having to do with race, but sometimes referring to gender, sexuality, socioeconomic status, and a host of other factors. And I thought it was a very interesting spin on the argument. It was interesting because it had nothing to do with the argument. It's what we like to call a complete and total straw man. I just want to read for you a few of the lines taken directly from this article and just comment on them. First, the author starts off with, "Liberals have a new word for what normal people call success. They call it privilege, as if a happy, prosperous life is a result of some magic process related to where your great-great-great-grandfather came from." All right, already we could tell this is a complete and total straw man. Privilege is not synonymous with success. Even in the most extreme form, the whole idea of privilege can be seen as the reason for somebody's success. And again, that's in the most extreme form. Generally, people say that privilege is a contributor to one's success. And this idea comes from the overwhelming evidence in the social sciences showing that some groups of people have it a heck of a lot easier than other groups. In my opinion, ignoring this fact is right up there with denying evolution and the crazy theory that the Earth is more than 6,000 years old. But of course, if one's totally accustomed to denying science, then I could see how they could kind of screw this up. Now here's a classic line. He says, "It's the latest leftist argument tactic, which means it is a tactic designed to prevent any argument and to beat you into rhetorical submission." Say what? A leftist argument tactic? That's what that means? To prevent any argument and beat you into rhetorical submission? But apparently a rightist argument tactic doesn't mean the same thing for some reason. Don't quite understand that part. He continues, "It's easy to see that this notion that the accomplishment comes not from hard work, but from some mysterious force operating out there in the ether," which doesn't exist, by the way, "is essential to liberal thought." Well, this force that he is referring to is called prejudice and bias. And it's only mysterious to people who refuse to listen to people who study such social phenomena. The author writes, "This check your privilege meme is the newest trump card du jour on college campuses and in other domains of progressive tyranny." Of course, associating education once again with tyranny. "It is morphed into existence from the 'you racist' wolf cry that is now so discredited that it produces little but snickers even among the liberal fellow travelers. After all, if everyone is racist, and to the progressives, everyone except themselves, then no one is really racist." Now, before I bash virtually everything he just said, I do want to point out that he does make a small valid point. Every spectrum, by definition, has an extreme, and the liberal spectrum is no different. There are people on the extreme end who do adopt a sort of Affleck-esque hypersensitivity to the whole idea of racism, referring to too many things as gross and racist. But putting aside the extreme exaggerations, the use of absolutes, such as everyone except themselves, is racist. This is a perfect example of black and white thinking, which is very common among the heavily religious, and I would even say the extreme conservatives. In this sense, someone is either racist or they're not racist. Forget about having racist ideas or racist thoughts, or even making racist comments, or even being mildly racist instead of extremely racist. His point is much stronger by ignoring that fact and creating a false dichotomy where one of the choices is so absurd that nobody could possibly be in that category, of course, leaving his category as the default reasonable category. And here's the real kicker, and the point of his whole article. His point is that when somebody brings up white privilege, or privilege, check your privilege, or any of the derivations of this whole idea, the proper response is to say, what you call privilege is just me being better than you. That's right. It's just me being better than you. And he continues to say that this should not be an argument. They only deserve laughter. So this whole idea of social inequality, essentially, only deserves laughter in the author's eyes. It doesn't even deserve any kind of rational debate. Now, I've seen many forms of the same argument being thrown out, and it has to do with some a picture of some really poor old white guy. And the title of the article says something like, "Where's my privilege?" And the whole article is basically surrounding this sample of one. To paraphrase Steve Colbert, it's like saying that because I'm not hungry, then hunger is not a problem in the world. And just because Hugh Hefner has sex 6 times a day, we don't say that 88-year-olds are the most sexually active age group. And here's a little secret, an unwritten rule of sleazy rhetoric. When statistics fail you, go with the anecdote. We can't take a sample size of one and then generalize that to the entire population. But what we could do is we could take one example to disprove the overall conclusion. Now, it should be crystal clear to anybody that Prince Harry and Kate's baby has quite an advantage in life compared to an African baby born to a starving single mother. Now, from this, we can reason that advantages and disadvantages exist on a spectrum. Any nonsense, such as that found in this article, that dismisses the entire idea of privilege without even attempting to understand the legitimate points of the argument, it's, well, nonsense. Now, of course, if we look closely at pretty much any argument, no matter how nonsensical it may be, we're apt to find a kernel of truth. Being privileged is not a guarantee for success, and one cannot automatically conclude that those who have achieved success only did so as a result of their privileged status. And I think that is probably the realistic point behind this article, if there is such a thing to this article. But likewise, being disadvantaged is not a guarantee for failure. And those who refuse to try in life because of the hand that they've been dealt would be wise to know the difference between an obstacle and a dead end. So do certain people have it easier than others due to circumstances beyond their control? Without a doubt. What should we do about it? Well, that's a whole other issue that is worthy of rational discourse, and not an issue that should be dismissed by laughter. Today's show is on the topic of critical thinking. And when I read an article like this, the first thing that comes to my mind is, does this have to do with a lack of critical thinking? But you want to avoid that knee-jerk reaction and come to the conclusion that anything that you read that's different from your opinion is because the person's not a critical thinker, or because the person is uneducated, or something else having to do with the person just pretty much being stupid. The person who wrote this is a lawyer. So he's obviously well-educated, But education and critical thinking are not the same things. It's been said before that all of us have a lawyer and a scientist inside of us. Basically, that's a way of saying that we think in two different ways and we communicate in two different ways. One is very analytical. The other one is just to be persuasive. So we might want to massage the truth a little bit in order to get somebody to accept our point. Now, sometimes it's obvious that facts take a back seat when values get in the way. Some people have these biases and values that are just so strong that it doesn't matter what the facts are. There's always a way to massage the truth to make their values and their biases and their beliefs a little bit more persuasive than the actual facts themselves. You know, this isn't too much unlike the whole idea of lying for Jesus. Just imagine if you really, truly believed that anybody who does not accept Jesus is going to hell. I mean, you really believed this. Then wouldn't it make sense to massage the truth, to lie as much as you can in order to get people to believe in Jesus? Because ultimately, you're saving their eternal soul. So sure, you may have a little white lie here on earth, but that's nothing compared to the eternal suffering of another person. So from that perspective, it makes complete and total sense. But what if you value economic prosperity over something, say, like rationality? Based on that hierarchy of values, it wouldn't be inconsistent of you to be irrational in your debate and in your argumentation and in the articles you write for townhall.com, to favor the promotion of your ideal or value over reason. And I really think this is what happens quite often. It's not a matter of people not thinking critically. It's just simply a matter of people not really caring that much about critical thinking, or at least valuing it a lot less than they value other things. Now, this isn't a problem with one solution. This is one of those problems with many potential solutions. One, of course, being the promotion and the emphasis on critical thinking and rational thought. And this is something that most of us are doing within the humanist movement, and I think it's a wonderful thing, of course. Which brings us to today's show and today's guest. Our guest is a cool guy I met on the internet a few years ago. I found him because he was doing a lot of great work in the area of critical thinking. And I came across a bunch of his videos, and I said, this is the kind of guy that I want to party with. And when I say party, I mean talk critical thought. So I had to get him on the show. His name is Dr. Kevin DeLaPlante. And if you've ever Googled critical thinking before, the chances are you've come across some of his materials. He has an incredible podcast out there all about critical thinking and courses on critical thinking. So right after the break, we're going to talk to Dr. Kevin DeLaPlante all about critical thought. Coming up on the Humanist Hour. Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Beau Bennett. And today I'm speaking with my guest, Dr. Kevin DeLaPlante, on the topic of critical thinking. How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm doing great. Thanks very much.
Great. Well, can you start off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Okay. I'm a professor of philosophy here at Iowa State University in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies. Been here since 1999. I'm a philosopher of science by training. My undergrad degree was in physics. I did graduate studies in philosophy of physics and the philosophy of science. Did most of my dissertation work, though, in the philosophy of ecology and environmental philosophy, actually. That's where I did most of the publishing I had to do for tenure. Mm-hmm. Since moving to Iowa State, I've been teaching critical thinking as a regular course load since the very beginning, including courses in the philosophy of science and in symbolic logic. So over that time, I've developed a greater appreciation for the importance of critical thinking and how it should be taught and how it shouldn't be taught and its relevance. And over the past 5 years or so, I guess I've focused more on developing critical thinking resources for a broader public. And I guess that's what I've been focusing most of my attention on in the past recent while.
Yes, you have. You've been doing a good job at it as well.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you a little bit about teaching the philosophy of religion. Obviously, you teach this, well, I shouldn't say obviously. I'm assuming that you teach this from a secular perspective or just a non-religious perspective, if there's a difference. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, if you teach philosophy of religion, there's a standard history to it. It is explicitly secular in the sense that the philosophical enterprise is about looking for arguments in favor of positions on the subject matter. The subject matter is religion and religious belief and so on. So in that sense, the project has to be secular if it's going to be a traditional philosophical project. But of course, there are plenty of people who teach philosophy of religion who themselves are not secular. Mm-hmm. They may happen to be believers of some kind or other. But when they're teaching, teaching from the standpoint of presenting arguments, criticizing arguments, and at that level, a faith commitment doesn't enter into the methodology, really.
And do you think they really honor that, or do you think they let it slip in anyway?
There's a kind of a debate among philosophers of religion, I think, about the extent to which religious believers might gravitate to teaching those courses, and that the academic work that's done is maybe a little less critical than it would be as viewed by non-believing philosophers. Mm-hmm. So there's some internal debate within the field about whether or not that's a problem. And I don't really have a stake in that debate myself. I know there's a similar debate, for example, in Old Testament and New Testament religious studies,
sure.
For example. But I mean, Hector Avalos has written about this, that the field, that the discipline tends to be attracts people who have an ideological view a lot of them tend to be believers. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that that's a corrupting influence of some kind on the field.
All right, well, let's move on and talk about your five pillars of critical thinking. What are they?
Sure. So I started writing about this topic a while ago when I realized in my classes that I was teaching, you know, I teach a little bit of symbolic logic, and I realized that when you do argument evaluation, you're really doing way more than just doing logic. Argument evaluation, the fundamental question of logic is what follows from what? The fundamental question of a theory of argumentation is what counts as a good reason to believe something. Mm-hmm. So what counts as a good versus bad argument? And that's a much broader question because it requires that you consider grounds for judging whether a premise is plausible or not. So that's the truth value of the premises themselves. And there's no formal algorithm for doing that. And then on top of that, it's not just logic and argumentation. Things like rhetoric, things like the discursive context in which you're arguing, like, for example, standards of evaluation. What counts as good reasoning in one domain might differ. For example, a scientific paper, what counts as good reasoning there might be different from, say, a courtroom argument. Where the standards, the critical standards of discourse are different, right? So you have to have, so the rhetorical context makes a difference to whether a piece of reasoning is successful or not. And then there are things like background knowledge. I think the dirty secret, I call it, of critical thinking education is that the bulk of it can't be taught in any traditional way, because the bulk of it turns on your background knowledge. Namely, the whole question of whether you think a premise is plausible to believe or not really tends to turn on your background knowledge of the subject matter, which isn't the kind of thing you can learn out of a critical thinking textbook. If it's a discussion about politics, you have to learn politics. If it's about physics, you have to learn some physics, and so forth. And also included in that sort of bundle of what I call background knowledge, or things like background knowledge about cognitive biases and the way our minds work. So the whole field of the psychology of self-deception, for example, which is really relevant to assessing whether your own judgments are reliable or not, and under what situations they will be, is a type of background knowledge that is really relevant to becoming a skilled critical thinker. And moving down the line, things like attitudes and values, there seem to be some set of normative values that critical thinkers have to adopt. Like, we should recoil from the notion that our beliefs are contradictory, right? When someone tells me that you believe B and then you believe also not B, that should be a problem for us, right? That should say, oh, I have to change something. I shouldn't be willing to indulge that. But also things like norms of objectivity, of having allowing an argument to take you wherever it goes, even if it goes places where it's going to make me uncomfortable. Those are value issues. Also things like the value of saying I don't know in answer to a question. That it's okay to suspend judgment because you don't have sufficient reasons to believe something or not. Those are culturally inculcated, socialized value judgments that I think are necessary for effective critical thinking. So when you put these all together, what you have is a multidimensional space where some people can be really good in some aspects of this and others not. So there are people who are really good at logic. Like they're very good at logic puzzles, they can follow a chain of reasoning well, for example, but their background knowledge is so poor in a particular area that they'll always make bad critical judgments about arguments in that domain. And vice versa. You can have someone who has sort of middling to not very great logical reasoning skills, but if their background knowledge is really strong, they'll tend to make much better judgments. Also, if someone's rhetorical skills are really poor, they may well have be able to sort of formulate arguments and objections and so on, but they'll never convince anybody of anything because they don't understand how to address an audience that already comes with their preconceived background and notions and what's required to sort of to engage properly with an audience where they have to be the ones who judge whether your premises are plausible, and they have to be the ones who judge whether or not the reasoning is strong enough. So I've seen that as well. So what you get is a kind of a profile of different competencies that are component skills for critical thinking, and people have them in various proportions. So some people are strong in some and weak in others. I think of it like a 5-channel equalizer, you know, where you can move the dials up and down. And so people tend to come with these different sort of skill sets. And the other part of this picture is that when you bring someone into a new critical thinking context, like they have to evaluate an argument or they have to make a decision or they have to sort of plan something, some encounter or something, then the skill sets that are required to make a good judgment in that case can differ from case to case. So what happens is that there's both a skill set that an individual brings to the table, what they're good or bad at, and then the critical thinking situation has a certain requirements that is for successful thinking about the topic. It's kind of a lock and key thing, right? Where there's a case where if I was judging whether or not a new scientific discovery should lead us to overthrow a particular scientific theory, the skill set needed to be a good critical judge of that is going to be very different than if I'm asked to judge whether or not the latest Supreme Court judgment on a particular ruling is constitutional or not, right? Or similarly, if I'm asked to give my children, my teenage children want to engage with me in an argument about whether or not it's okay for them to smoke pot. Right? Very different context. The skill sets in order to do that well, to do this well, is going to be very different. And I think this is a sort of unappreciated feature of critical thinking that it has all these different components. It's not just logic. It's not just argumentation, but includes rhetoric, psychology, background knowledge, and attitudes and values. And they all sort of come together. And when it's working well, when someone's really succeeding in their critical thinking, all five of these tend to be flying in formation. That is, they're mutually supporting each other. And I think that's also an underappreciated feature of critical reasoning, that in fact, successful occasions of critical thinking involve a lot of these different parts or skill sets working together in order to achieve the outcome.
Let's say, for example, that I was brought up in another country. I was brought up in a country where it was very common to oppress women. And this was my background knowledge. This is my cultural values. So therefore, in engaging in a debate and talking about these issues as to why women should be oppressed, I would come to a different conclusion given my background knowledge and my culture,
right.
Whereas
right.
somebody like an American perhaps would come to a different conclusion, a more progressive or liberal conclusion about equality.
Right.
So in that sense, can one of us be more right than the other, in your opinion?
I think that's a different question from whether or not the different players can be equally competent critical thinkers about the situation.
And I guess that's what I was getting at, because a lot of times somebody will look at somebody coming from a different perspective, having different background with different values, and they will accuse that person of not thinking critically.
Yeah.
When in fact, maybe they are thinking critically, they're just coming from it with different values, which is leading them to a different conclusion. And I think that's what you were getting at with your background knowledge.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, at some point, the judgment that someone's thinking critically or not becomes not that helpful, because what you want to know is know exactly where the differences are. So if you and I disagree, or this person and I disagree on the justification of the treatment of women, mm-hmm. what I want to do is figure out what the actual set of reasoning, what the actual reasoning is, and the background beliefs are, so that if I want to engage with that person, I know what it is that I'm dealing with, right? And similarly, if they want to engage constructively with me on this, they have to figure out where I'm coming from. It may well be that the difference turns on socialization, in which certain background premises become highly plausible for them but not plausible for us, right? So in that sense, what you've done is you've sort of diagnosed the problem at the level of a primary difference in background knowledge or background beliefs. In that case, both at this level, both of us could be equally rational in the sense that we're sort of arguing consistently within a set of background beliefs. But then the challenge is going to be, I'll say, well, your background beliefs are not plausible because they're challenged by these various facts that we've learned about human nature. For example, women are not different in this way, or you have a value system which is different. Where, for example, Anthony Appiah has written a lot about the role of honor codes mm-hmm. in explaining these kinds of cultural differences. That is, you have a culture that in which honor plays an important, is a virtue that plays in a really important social, structural role. And the honor codes are ways of acquiring honor and earning honor and losing honor. And these can be socially distributed so that they're not attached to individuals, but they can be attached to families and lineages and social groups. So one person's shame in being sexually assaulted can transfer dishonor onto the family line, for example, which results in things like honor killings or whatnot. His approach to this is that you don't have a chance of critically engaging with people from this cultural background unless you can engage them at the level of what actually does contribute to honor or not. You know, so his view is that if you want to have a critical engagement, you have to get inside, get as close as you can to where they live, to where their headspace is, and then push them in directions to realize that this practice you have doesn't have to constitute a violation of an honor code, for example. And it's only in that sort of incremental way, when you're sort of inside the gate, that you have a chance of moving them. But they can be moved because he has all these examples of the abandonment of cultural traditions over time, based on internal criticism, which shows that it's possible.
I guess I was thinking framework, this whole idea of working inside somebody's framework.
Right.
In order to communicate with them better. So if they're not being responsive to the reasons that you're given, maybe you need to switch your perspective and try to look at things from their perspective, get inside their framework, and see if there are any internal inconsistencies that you could point out that they would understand or reasons that they would accept based on their perspective.
Yeah, this is where I think that research by people like Jonathan Haidt and what's his name? Joshua Green. These moral psychologists who study different kind of moral frameworks, mm-hmm. moral cognitive types, is valuable because it does give a framework, a perspective for thinking. Oh, you're thinking in terms of you're sort of an autonomy person, or you're a consequentialist person, or you're sort of an authoritarian type, or you're driven by these other, and once you sort of get the measure of their moral psychology, then you have some openings for engagement. I think a good exercise is try to imagine you sitting down with them and trying to convince them that you understand their perspective. So what you want to be able to do is to say, this is where I think you're coming from. And you tell them their reasoning. And if you can get to the point where their head starts to nod and they say, yes, that's exactly it. You've got it, right? Mm-hmm. Then at that moment, then you've opened the door to a comment or an objection or something that has a chance of moving them. It's exactly where they live. They wouldn't see you as someone, as a complete outsider, right? You've got to get very close to a way of thinking that's not yours and be sympathetic to it. You don't have to agree with it, but I think maybe the right word is empathetic to it. Hmm. You have to be, if you can sort of see the world from their point of view, that ends up being the ideal position from which to constructively engage them.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm speaking with Dr. Kevin De La Plante on critical thinking.
So there's a kind of irony, right, where the best place to be in terms of your ability to influence a debate is being as close as you can get to the mindset of your opponent.
Gotcha.
Right? So that's a skill that is, I think, not generally reinforced or taught in the critical thinking community, right?
Yeah, that's for sure. It does sound a lot like this is part of the creative process that is often overlooked in critical thinking. And that's why I think there are some courses that do focus on creative and critical thinking as a combination, because the two are so intertwined. All right, so let's spend some time talking about some practical applications of critical thinking. As you know, there are a lot of people who say, yeah, critical thinking, that sounds great. I'd love to do critical thinking, but it's just not that important to me right now. I have to pay the bills. I have to pick the kids up from school. I got to do everything else comes first, it seems like. How can we talk to these people, and how could we communicate with them to tell them about the importance of critical thinking in everyday lives? What are just some ways?
Well, I would say that it's the view that they, that people don't have time in their busy schedules for critical thinking is just a misunderstanding of what critical thinking is about. So I would say once you clarify what the goals are, then people will appreciate the relevance of it. For example, if I would say that the goal of critical thinking is twofold. One is to improve the quality of your beliefs and your judgments and your choices, right? Mm-hmm. Then if what you care about is truth, for example, then that's a quality that's going to matter to you. If your choices, you want them to be instrumentally rational and valuable to actually lead to your goals, then everyone can appreciate that they want their choices to be reasonable, to promote their own goals and ends. They want their judgments to be justified and so forth. And the other part of the goal of critical thinking is something like autonomy, like being the kind of person who can take, who can be the agent of your own beliefs and values, that you are, this is a notion of an independent thinker, someone who thinks for themselves. And almost no one wants to be the person who says, I don't want to think for myself. They just won't. They won't say that, right? So those are widely shared values. People can get on board with that. And when you notice that even at that level of description, even the ordinary mundane things in their lives can relate to that. Everyone has goals that they're trying to accomplish, if it's raising children or making money or getting a new job or whatever, then critical thinking can apply to these, even those mundane, everyday, daily things. The other thing, I think there's a scale that you can go out is once you, if people got were to be educated about the degree to which their beliefs and judgments are being aggressively targeted by the influence business in terms of politics, advertising, and so forth, that there's this entire ecosystem of propaganda agents and message spinners, and our environment is flooded with this, so that we're surrounded by messages that are carefully designed to try to influence what we believe and what we do. And almost all of those messages have nothing to do with your individual best interest. That is, they almost all of them have to do with interests of other groups or parties.
Sure.
Then once you start to see that, then you realize that critical thinking is minimally a kind of logical self-defense that that can help to protect you from the manipulations that are constantly going on around you. I think people can get on board with that. I think a lot of people are aware of certain areas of public life where they feel manipulated. And so they can get on board easily with, okay, I'd like to be a better critical thinker about that because I really resent it when the government does this or advertising does that or so on. And then you can scale up from there to things like the personal empowerment that critical reasoning skills can give you, but also, you know, scale up even higher to things like the, you know, social, your sort of duties as a citizen, or broader still, your ability to think critically about big important questions that matter to you, like life and death and value, ethics and God and so forth. There's a range of things that people can find attractive about what you can do with critical thinking. Some of them tend to be closer to home for some people, in the sense they tend to be about their daily lives and they don't really have much interest in the bigger philosophical issues. But some people do drift that way. And I think what you have is applications right from very self-interested, mundane types of issues all the way up to the biggest questions possible.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point, that there are certainly different levels of how critical thinking can help. For example, you mentioned a lot of the big levels coming from the 10,000 foot view. I also have a whole bunch of little things that always come to me every now and then. I always jot them down because I think they're interesting. For example, before I really got into critical thinking, one of the things that I used to catch myself doing quite often was when my wife, primarily my wife, would tell me something like, I told you this last week. Mm-hmm. I would automatically say, no, you didn't. You never told me that. You didn't tell me that. And we'd get into an argument and it wouldn't be pretty. However, nowadays, I realize that how flawed memory is and all right. the biases associated with it. And the chances are, if she thinks she told me, she probably told me, knowing right. me.
Right.
And now I respond yeah. with, yes, you probably did. I apologize. I didn't remember. And there's no conflict anymore. And it's just... it's little things like that. That's not a big deal, but little things like that piled on and multiplied in everyday communication and conversation really make a difference.
I think you're absolutely right about that. The cognitive bias literature, if you internalize it well, can really make you open up your eyes about who you are and how you relate to other people in a way that can be both, you know, troubling when you realize what you're prone to doing, but also right. liberating, right? In that maybe there are things, changes that you can make that have a positive impact and can be productive in terms of the way that you relate to other people and sort of dialogue. Your interpersonal skills can really be benefited. Knowing things like, you know, the halo effect. If I think that someone is good at this one thing,
Right.
I'm likely going to think that they're good at other things as well, with no evidence for that.
Exactly.
And similarly, the anti-halo effect, or whatever that's called, if I find that someone's bad at something, I'll tend to think that they're going to be bad at other things as well, with no evidence for that.
Right.
Now, once I realize that I'm prone to that, you can really avoid or promote more productive communications with other people and in your relationships by not generalizing, being careful about your generalizations, or allowing for complexity in people's personalities, that they can be, strong in one area and weak in others, and that's okay.
Hmm.
And I think there's just a myriad of examples like this, right, where your sort of daily experience of yourself in the world can be changed, transformed by becoming familiar with some of these ideas.
Right. Yeah. When I wrote my first book, I included 50 different profiles of people that I had some admiration for because of certain things that they've done in their lives, mostly related to business or success or something along those lines. And I got a lot of comments about some of those that people weren't very happy with me because they said, did you know Henry Ford was a Nazi? And
right.
I said, well, yeah, I did. And I didn't write about him because I appreciate his Nazism.
Right.
I wrote about him because of his accomplishments in business and what he did with wages. And they don't seem to be able to disconnect the two. They give him, as you said, the anti-halo or the pitchfork effect and say, yeah, he's a bad guy. So therefore, everything he does is bad and nothing is worthy of admiration. And that's just a terrible way to look at things, because almost definitely you could look at any individual in this world and you could see something wrong with them. And if you have that attitude and that mindset, then people are just horrible in general. And you're going to go through life with that attitude. And that's just a bad perspective to have.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's also a dangerous view. I mean, you can be sympathetic, I suppose, because no one likes to be told, Hitler really was a great economics reasoner or whatever, or a great
right.
speaker. Because okay,
right.
he's like sort of the tainted example. But for things like, let's say the halo effect or the pitchfork effect can combine with other forms of confirmation bias and stereotype thinking, where you have you observe one person who fits within some kind of stereotypical category, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a minority of some kind, and they do some one thing that that fits the stereotype, and then all of a sudden your mind associates to they must fulfill all the categories of your stereotype.
Right.
That's a very dangerous thing to do. That gets us into profiling. It gets us into the kind of noxious stereotyping that is at the root of various kinds of prejudice. And in order to combat that, you have to be able to disentangle, different types of character virtues.
Right. Well, let me play
or vices.
Devil's advocate for a moment here, because the argument has been made, and this makes sense on some level, that the reason that we have these heuristics and the reason that we stereotype is because essentially it works. People do tend to have these certain characteristics like in groups.
Mm-hmm.
So as kind of a mental shortcut, if we see somebody doing X, then with a certain amount of probability, we could say that they're probably going to do Y and Z as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thinking, it helped us in evolution, and that's why it's so dominant today. What would you have to say about that?
Well, maybe two things about that. The first is, grant the point that stereotypes often, judging based on a stereotype can often be reliable in the sense that it turns out the fact that when you thought that if you saw someone do X and you think that they might also do Y because of a stereotype, and they in fact do Y, or they in fact are disposed to do Y.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right about that. Then it turns out that your judgment is reliable. Grant that happens some portion of the time. But there is also, I mean, the language about stereotyping being based on a bias that works needs to be clarified, because the way that stereotypes work for us in an evolutionary sense is that they help us make decisions quickly, right? So So the explanation, for example, of why our sort of system one or type one thinking, you know, which is fast,
right,
and based on stereotypes and associations, is that it's not adaptive, functionally adaptive, to weigh all the pros and cons of a particular situation in a kind of deliberative way, because that uses up time and energy, and by then you might be dead, right? So you have to make quick judgments in real time, and so we use these shortcuts, these heuristics that are adaptive in the sense that they, more often than not, can help to resolve a problem or address, you know, they make us prone to errors, but they also have these positive effects.
Sure.
So the sense in which the heuristic, the stereotyping is useful is because it reduces cognitive load. If we didn't do that, at least a lot of the time, we wouldn't be functional human beings anymore, actually. It is actually essential for normal, healthy psychological functioning that our stereotyping circuits are working well and regularly. That said, once you have learned that there's this domain where that the stereotyping has these potentially serious negative ethical consequences, for example, with gender discrimination or racial discrimination, then we have a reason for our system too, our slow thinking of, you know, capacity to double check, to go online and intervene in what would otherwise be an automatic process. So here's where I think that a good understanding of like our, you know, system one, system two thinking set up would give us the result that these are precisely the cases where we have reason to be more deliberative,
mm-hmm.
even if sometimes the stereotyping is reliable, there are these other considerations, ethical considerations and social political considerations that are also relevant. And that would give us reason to not simply, you know, embrace the output of our stereotyping module, you know,
right,
just because sometimes it's reliable.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That certainly is a good point. I'm thinking too of the classic example that we are sort of geared by nature, equipped to eat everything in sight and
right,
eat sugary foods. But nowadays it's very disadvantageous for us to do such a thing. So we need to kick our reasoning in, and we need to look at this delicious looking cake and say, ah, you know, that looks delicious. I would love to eat it, but I'm not going to.
Right.
And that's something that we didn't have to do, you know, 20,000, 30,000 years ago. And I think that's a good point what you made. Nowadays, when we see somebody of a different race or a different sex or anything coming towards us, we can't have these initial feelings that just come from our system one processing. We need to, we could accept those, and that's okay that we have those, but we need to kick our system two in and say, okay, well, this is unreasonable because, and then just go down the reasoning process. Very interesting stuff. All right, Kevin, thank you so much for being on with us. I really appreciate it. So, Kevin, where can people find out more information about you and what you're doing?
Well, sure. Well, I have a site which hosts a number of video tutorials on critical thinking. It's called criticalthinkeracademy.com. I have a version of a critical thinker course that has a ton of material in it which is hosted on Udemy. It's also called Critical Thinker Academy,
mm-hmm.
on Udemy, which is currently running a discount deal. And for viewers or listeners of the podcast, I'd be happy to give a discount code in the show notes for people to, if they want to explore this further. So what I have is about 14 hours worth of video tutorials that cover a range of topics on critical thinking, ranging from basic logic and argumentation, to cognitive biases, to critical thinking about science, and also some other aspects, fallacies, that's a place where I'm sort of adding new material all the time. It includes like 600 pages worth of PDF transcripts.
Wow.
And some quizzing tools as well. So it's a pretty good deal. But yeah, so if you want to follow the blog on Critical Theory Academy, I post updates there. I'm working on a new course right now on essay writing, actually, which is I'm interested in because, you know, one of my things has been that critical reasoning also requires a consideration of rhetoric about the ways in which speech becomes persuasive to particular audiences. And one of the things I'm doing in this course on writing is talking about different traditions of rhetoric that apply to different kinds of essay styles. And so I think it reinforces this view that I have that if you want to become a more persuasive advocate for your own viewpoints, learning something about the rhetorical traditions in which you're writing can really help to improve that. It isn't just a matter of logic and argumentation. It also has to require an understanding of audience and context, for example.
Right.
So stay tuned for that.
All right. Well, sounds like you're up to a lot of cool things. So once again, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, that'll wrap up another episode of the Humanist Hour. If you do have any feedback for us, we'd love to hear from you. Send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org, or you can call our listener feedback line, and that number is 202-618-1371. Thank you very much for listening again, and we'll see you next week on the Humanist Hour. Bye-bye, everybody.